We come to a classic imposition like this, and at first we feel helpless. We are told that this thing is so. It is as if we were modes of motion and must go on, but are obstructed by an absolute bar of ultimate steel, shining, in our way, with an infinite polish. But all appearances are illusions. No one with a microscope doubts this, no one who has gone specially from ordinary beliefs into minuter examination of any subject doubts this, as to his own specific experience. So then, broadly, that all appearances are illusions, and that, by this recognition, we shall dissipate resistances, monsters, dragons, oppressors that we shall meet in our pilgrimage. This bar-like calculation is itself a mode of motion. The static cannot absolutely resist the dynamic, because in the act of resisting it becomes itself proportionately the dynamic. We learn that modifications rusted into the steel of our opposition. The period of Algol, which Vogel carried out to a minute's 55th second, was, after all, so incompetently determined that the whole imposition was nullified. Astronomical Journal, 11-113. That, according to Chandler, Algol and his companion do not revolve around each other merely, but revolve together around some second imperceptibility regularly. Bull. SOC. Astro. De France, October, 1910. That M. Mora has shown that in Algol's variations there were irregularities that neither Vogel nor Chandler had accounted for. The companion of Sirius looms up to our recognition that the story must be nonsense, or worse than nonsense, or that two light comedies will now disappear behind something darker. The story of the companion of Sirius is that Professor Ahlers, having observed, or in his mania for a pencil and something to scribble upon, having supposed he had observed, motions of the star Sirius, had deduced the existence of a companion, and had inevitably calculated its orbit. Early in the year 1862, Alvin Clark, Jr., turned his new telescope upon Sirius, and there, precisely where, according to Ahlers' calculations, it should be, saw the companion. The story is told by Proctor, writing 30 years later, the finding of the companion, in the precise position of the calculations, Proctor's statement that, in the 30 years following, the companion had conformed fairly well with the calculated orbit. According to the Annual Record of Science and Industry, 1876-18, the companion, in half the time mentioned by Proctor, had not moved in the calculated orbit. In the Astronomical Register, 15-186, there are two diagrams by Flammarion. One is the orbit of the companion, as computed by Ahlers, the other is the orbit, according to a mean of many observations. They do not conform fairly well. They do not conform at all. I am now temporarily accepting that Flammarion and the other observing astronomers are right, and that the writers like Proctor, who do not say that they made observations of their own, are wrong, though I have data for thinking that there is no such companion star. When Clark turned his telescope upon Sirius, the companion was found exactly where Ahlers said it would be found. According to Flammarion and other astronomers, had he looked earlier or later it would not have been in this position. Then, in the name of the one calculus that astronomers seem never to have heard of, by what circumstances could that star have been precisely where it should be, when looked for, January 31, 1862, if, upon all other occasions, it would not be where it should be? Astronomical Register, 1-94. A representation of Sirius but with six small stars around him. An account, by Dr. Dawes, of observations, by Goldschmidt, upon the companion and five other small stars near Sirius. Dr. Dawes' accusation, or opinion, is that it scarcely seems possible that some of these other stars were not seen by Clark. If Alvin Clark saw six stars, at various distances from Sirius, and picked out the one that was at the required distance, as if that were the only one, he dignifies our serials with a touch of something other than comedy. For Goldschmidt's own announcement, see Monthly Notices, RAS, 23-181, 243. 5. smugness and falseness and sequences of readjusting fatalities, and yet so great is the hypnotic power of astronomic science that it can outlive its mortal blows by the simple process of forgetting them, and, in general, simply by denying that it can make mistakes. Upon page 245, Old and New Astronomy, Richard Proctor says the ideas of astronomers in these questions of distance have not changed, and, in the present position of astronomy, based, in such respects, on absolute demonstration, they cannot change. Sounds that have roared in the sky, and their vibrations have shaken down villages, if these be the voices of development, commanding that opinions shall change, we shall learn what will become of the proctors and their absolute demonstrations. Lights that have appeared in the sky, that they are gleams upon the armament of marching organization. There can be only one explanation of meteors. I think it is that they are shining spear points of slayers of dogmas. I point to the sky over a little town in Perthshire, Scotland. There may be a new San Salvador, it may be a new Plymouth Rock. I point to the crater Aristarchus, of the moon there, for more than a century, a lighthouse may have been signaling. Whether out of profound meditations, or farrago and bewilderment, I point, directly, or miscellaneously, and, if only a few of a multitude of data be accepted, unformulable perturbations rack an absolute sureness, and the coils of our little horizons relax their constrictions. I indicate that, in these pages, which are banners in a cosmic procession, I do feel a sense of responsibility, but how to maintain any great seriousness I do not know, because still is our subject astronomical triumphs. Once upon a time there was a young man, aged 18, whose name was Jeremiah Horrocks. He was no astronomer. He was interested in astronomic subjects, but it may be that we shall agree that a young man of 18, who had not been heard of by one astronomer of his time, was an outsider. There was a transit of Venus in December, 1639, but not a grown-up astronomer in the world expected it, because the not always great and infallible Kepler had predicted the next transit of Venus for the year 1761. According to Kepler, Venus would pass below the Sun in December, 1639. But there was another calculation, it was by the great, but sometimes not so great, Landsberg, that, in December, 1639, Venus would pass over the upper part of the Sun. Jeremiah Horrocks was an outsider. He was able to reason that, if Venus could not pass below the Sun, and also over the upper part of the Sun, she might take a middle course. Venus did pass over the middle part of the Sun's disk, and Horrocks reported the occurrence, having watched it. I suppose this was one of the most agreeable humiliations in the annals of busted inflations. One thinks sympathetically of the joy that went out from 17th century Philistines. The story is told to this day by the Proctors and Balls and Newcombs, the way they tell this story of the boy who was able to conclude that something that could not occupy two extremes might be intermediate, and thereby see something that no professional observer of the time saw, is a triumph of absorption. That the transit of Venus, in December, 1639, was observed by Jeremiah Horrocks, the great astronomer. We shall make some discoveries as we go along, and some of them will be worse thought of than others, but there is a discovery here that may be of interest, the secret of immortality, that there is a mortal resistance to everything, but that the thing that can keep on incorporating, or assimilating within itself, its own mortal resistances, will live forever. By its absorptions, the science of astronomy perpetuates its inflations, but there have been instances of indigestion. See the New York Herald, September 16, 1909. Here Flammarion, who probably no longer asserts any such thing, claims Dr. Cook's discovery of the North Pole as an astronomical conquest. Also, there are other ways. One suspects that the treatment that Dr. Lascarbault received from Flammarion illustrates other ways. In the year 1859, it seems that Dr. Lascarbault was something of an astronomer. It seems that as far back as that he may have known a planet when he saw one, because, in an interview, he convinced Leverrier that he did know a planet when he saw one. He had at least heard of the planet Venus, because in the year 1882 he published a paper upon indications that Venus has an atmosphere. Largely because of an observation, or an announcement, of his, occurred the climax of Leverrier's fiascos, prediction of an intramercurial planet that did not appear when it should appear. My suspicion is that astronomers pardonably, but frailly, had it in for Lascarbault, and that in the year 1891 came an occurrence that one of them made an opportunity. Early in the year 1891, Dr. Lascarbault announced that, upon the night of January 11, 1891, he had seen a new star. At the next meeting of the French Academy, Flammarion rose, spoke briefly, and sat down without overdoing. He said that Lascarbault had discovered Saturn. If a navigator of at least 30 years' experience should announce that he had discovered an island, and if that island should turn out to be Bermuda, he would pair with Lascarbault as Flammarion made Lascarbault appear. Even though I am a writer upon astronomical subjects, myself, I think that even I should know Saturn, if I should see him, at least in such a period as the year 1891, when the rings were visible. It is perhaps an incredible mistake. However, it will be agreeable to some of us to find that astronomers have committed just such almost incredible mistakes.